A local vigil is planned tonight after unarmed men are shot by police. And in Dallas, five police officers are gunned down. Corrine Brown may be facing an indictment today in Jacksonville. And a new poll shows trouble for Angela Corey and Matt Shirk. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9, and now subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher with video on demand at our partner, TVJax.com. Just add all of the news of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, how the death of Joan Rivers can be seen as an example of how to avoid medical malpractice in the operating room. July is Medical Malpractice Awareness Month. We'll tell you about that, all of that and more ahead. But first, it's Friday, and it's been a very busy and tragic news week as we welcome our media roundtable here today. David Bauerlein of the Florida Times-Union. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Melissa.
Fred Matthews, who blogs at The Examiner, is here.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to see you. A.G. Gankarski, writer at Florida Politics.
Good morning.
And new to the panel, Mark Judson, managing editor of UNF's Spinnaker.
Good morning.
Good to see you guys. Lots to discuss. An indictment is expected today for Representative Corrine Brown. We're watching that story. There's also new polling showing trouble for State Attorney Angela Corey and Public Defender Matt Shirk. But we're going to begin the hour with our top story. Deadly gunfire overnight in Dallas killed five police officers during a protest over police violence, one of many that had sparked up around the country yesterday. Now, this latest tragedy happened after videos that have gone viral this week showed two African-American men shot by police, one in Louisiana and one in Minnesota. This has spurred protests and debate once again over police use of force across the country. Here in our area, there will be a vigil this evening in Springfield. More about that in a moment, but right now we want your calls as we discuss the news out of Dallas. What are your thoughts? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on Facebook. Fred Matthews, let's begin with you. The nation has simply been stunned by this series of events this week. We see the video of the man in Minnesota, another man in Louisiana, gunned down by a police officer. Then last night during a protest, five police officers were killed by authorities are now saying sniper fire.
This is one of those situations in which the social media that we all enjoy, that the newspapers, the 24-hour news cycle plays all over the planet and certainly plays all over the United States. Even though the officers and the police force in Dallas has been one of those that's been working to have community policing in place, hasn't had a real issue like this with citizens or police shooting with issues with citizens in quite some time, they were not going to be able to escape the broad brush that many people in minority communities across the country view of the police. The police are the police. And even though, as we heard on the press conference just moments ago, all of the facts aren't in on all of the shooters, what Chief David Brown was able to determine is that in this case, one of the shooters essentially was favoring the Black Lives Matter movement and was against white officers, white people. And this is according to what he says, which is all we can go by right now. They wanted to take some action.
And, you know, David Bauerlein, as we were listening to this news conference out of Texas, you could hear the sadness in the officers' voices as they simply pleaded for the nation to come together. The division and the anger that we're seeing is heartbreaking.
Absolutely. I turned in, just found out about this morning when I woke up and saw the news. It was shocking. There is a sense of what's next, what's going to happen next. And, you know, for people to come together and have a protest and officers to be there to essentially protect the protesters, make sure that nothing gets out of hand, and then have somebody with sniper fire mowing down officers is shocking.
Yeah. AG, tonight in Springfield, there's going to be a vigil at the corner of 9th and Liberty. That's in historic Springfield near the location where Jacksonville man Vernell Bing Jr. was shot and killed by police. Jacksonville's not unlike any other major city where there's controversy over this very topic.
Yeah, big time controversy. They've been having vigils there since Bing Jr. was shot weeks ago, and this is going to be a vigil that encompasses all of the various victims of police killings in the city. You know, and that's one side of the debate. On the other side of the debate, you have people like, you know, the mayor, Lenny Curry. I just got a statement from his office. Spokesperson Marsha Oliver said that the mayor is incredibly troubled by the events we've seen occurring across the country over the past several days. His first call this morning was to the sheriff, with whom he has spoken a few times already. And, you know, it's going to be a challenge for law enforcement, for city leaders with this vigil in the wake of Dallas, because, you know, policemen are all on guard. I saw Steve Zona, the head of the Fraternal Order of Police, post something to Facebook, you know, talking about the media who had basically egged this kind of thing on. So, you know, what we're going to see locally is what we're seeing nationally, you know, a stark divide between, you know, people who, for lack of a better phrase, say Blue Lives Matter and see what happened in Dallas as a vindication of the need to protect police rights, and people in these affected communities, you know, who deal with police violence on, you know, a weekly basis. There's a police shooting with numbing regularity. When I asked Mayor Curry about it last week, you know, well, what's going to be the tipping point? You know, he said he had full faith and confidence in Sheriff Williams. But, you know, at the same time, you've got issues like JSO overtime. You've got, you know, a lot of JSO operations being done in overtime, especially in these high, like, crime areas. And basically it means you're taking somebody who just came off a 12-hour shift and they're on their off day and they're being deployed in these areas. You know, we've got a lot of pressures in terms of law enforcement and civil order, and you know, it's a very complicated tapestry.
Mark Judson, we've heard from Fred and Agino about two competing movements and two competing points of view in this country, the Black Lives Matter movement, which has arisen in part out of controversy around these shootings of unarmed men that are often captured on video, and the Blue Lives Matter response, saying that police officers also deserve the right to go home to their families at night. Your thoughts?
Well, absolutely. I mean, everyone has the opportunity to be with their family, to go home, to do the job that they're trying to do and trying to get home. And I think that that's an issue that we see on both sides of these views. So I think that's what's happening, especially when you look at Black Lives Matter.
Uh-huh.
With the Black Lives Matter movement, is I think that a lot
speaking of cell phones, they can go off at the most interesting times. Go ahead.
I think that a lot of those individuals are feeling that they don't have that right, and that they're seeing, just based on what's coming up in social media and what's coming up on media around the country, that so far they haven't been guaranteed that right, that they're going to be able to go out and then they're going to be able to come home to their family.
And the office of Florida Governor Rick Scott has just issued a statement about the shooting of 12 law enforcement officers in Dallas, saying this morning, "We are heartbroken to hear of the horrendous tragedy that took place in Texas last night, a senseless and cowardly act." We're going to go to your calls right now as we discuss this story. What are your thoughts? 549-2937 to join us. Christian is in Jacksonville. Hi, Christian. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Doing okay, thanks.
I just found out about the shooting in Dallas this morning when I called my mom. She's actually out there. And, you know, it's a shame that the officers were shot. But on the same end, when these African-American men are getting shot and killed, there needs to be consequences. And I think that was the anger, you know, boiling over the pot, and that's kind of the end result. It's not justified, but it's just a reaction to what's been happening. I'm African-American as well, and it's really awkward, you know, having to talk to, like, my younger siblings about, you know, what happens when they get pulled over by a cop, because it's something that they have to be prepared for, like it's a test or something, and that was really all I wanted to say. Thank you.
All right, Christian, thanks for sharing that. David Bauerlein, do you think what do you think about his point of view?
Well, I think it's important to separate the protesters from somebody getting up and with a gun and
taking a sniper position.
Which is why I haven't had a chance to read Steve Zona's Facebook posting, but you know, to say that people protesting and going to these rallies are being egged on by the media. They're hearing the news. They're making their own decisions. They're going out and they're protesting against it. But I don't think the protesters there wanted police officers who were there to be shot. I just don't think that's the case.
And Fred, as you pointed out, when we talk about media fueling these flames, in large part, it's social media, as you said, as people share these status updates and videos on their own media platforms.
When you see what happened to the young man in Minnesota, his girlfriend is riding there, running, streaming this incident live straight to Facebook. She's calm up until the point that they put her in the back of the police car with the four-year-old, and then she loses it. This gets under your skin. This is what we're talking about. The media, quote, the mainstream media, which I guess we're part of at this point, isn't really fueling to this extent. I mean, this is what people are able to see. This is what they're feeling. And the unfortunate set of circumstances here, again, going back to what Chief Dave Brown said this morning, he's not going to militarize his police force. He's not going to put tanks on the street because that's not who they are. The problem he has is the same thing that Sheriff Williams has here, that they're having in other cities, is that they're all going to be victims of what people now see and believe to be. And if you see and believe it to be, it is. And that's what's going to be facing us now across this country. Again, we don't know the facts yet. We don't know all of the facts behind these particular shooters. But what we know enough to know that they were expert shooters. They had planned this out quite well. And obviously, with the assuming that the officers wore body armor, they were pretty good at headshots. So, I mean, this is an unfortunate situation that we hope does not escalate. But it is really going to take
I think that's a fear that's in the minds of many right now.
It is
now.
A fear, and yeah. There's some anger. I mean, there's just flat anger out there among folks, especially mm-hmm. young people. Mm-hmm. There's anger out there and misunderstanding. And what is this parallel to?
Let's go to a few more calls. CJ on the South Side. Go ahead, CJ.
Yes, good morning. I'm sorry to hear the news of the fallen officers. You know, every day they go out and they put their lives on the line, and you know, we just can't emphasize that the vast majority of police officers are good people, law-abiding citizens, and they just want to help a stable society. On the other hand, we have to try to prevent this negative feedback loop. Because now, obviously, officers will be extra vigilant with extra itchy trigger fingers, and we don't want to escalate the violence on either side. And there, you know, as far as protesters are concerned, protest is part of the American fabric. That's what we were founded on, and we need to be able to, you know, as far as the protests go, we need to really start to echo the words of Martin Luther King and really emphasize the nonviolence approach. We cannot have wars in the streets. I mean, this is a nice area of Dallas, and we can't have this urban warfare going on. And but at the same time, we cannot have officers overreacting and targeting and having this negative feedback loop of fear on both sides.
CJ, thanks. And here's a tweet from David saying, much the same, we want police to stop executing us. BS traffic stops that lead to felonies and death. But another tweet from Rachel says, what about celebrities fueling their impassioned followers? Beyonce made waves by bringing this to the stage. Lots of feedback. We'll go back to our panelists in just a moment. Let's get a few more of your calls as we discuss the tragedy of Dallas last night and everything related to it. Larry is downtown. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Like the other caller, you know, the vast majority of police officers are good people, but they're human beings, and there's a few that aren't good people. And the police departments all over the country could do a great service for themselves and the community if they, in every community, we had a board of civilians that would investigate wrongdoings by the police department, whether it be roughing somebody up or a killing or whatever. The police
investigating the police is a bad idea, and they fight against the regular civil board so much that it makes you wonder what they're trying to hide. If the police want to help themselves, for God's sakes, go to, you've got 100 retired judges in this town. You could put 5 retired judges on a board that would listen to complaints, and it would go a long ways to give some satisfaction to the citizens and the police department.
All right. Thanks, Larry. The issue of a civilian review board has come and gone many times over the years in this city. Mark Judson, as of right now, the JSO is saying they don't think that that is a necessary addition to the review process.
Yeah, I think that if you start to add these civilian boards that are coming up every time that there's an incident or every time that there's public outcry, I think that it's just going to become a bureaucratic mess, and you're going to get caught up in every situation being juried to where now we're having to look over every single thing that's happening all the time, and it comes down to a board that might not be the most knowledgeable on what the laws are or what's happening in that situation.
David Bauerlein.
Well, I think that that's something that the city's going to have to seriously look at, is a civilian review board. To me, it does different perspectives and brings out facts. It's a more public venue. I think it's something that they should look at closely. Certainly think that body cameras are something they should be looking at. They're moving that direction, it seems. But to Fred's point, I mean, I saw all this on the mainstream media, but I saw social media was the source of the reporting. And these are all split-second encounters in which things happen very quickly, and the tail of the tape tells what happened.
And that's what's changed. Anyone can now record video and share it to the world within a matter of a couple of minutes.
Yeah, and the JSO is actually rolling out a body camera pilot program. You know, it's going to basically get started in January. You're going to see evidence of it in the spring and summer on the streets. The issue is information storage. The issue is infrastructure and recurring budgetary impacts. Regarding civilian review board, though, it's going to be tough because the charter, you know, basically gives the sheriff's office constitutional officer status. It's an elected position. It's not appointed by the mayor. It's not, you know, decided by council. You know, therefore, you know, sheriff's office has autonomy in this role, and the sheriff's office doesn't want it. The Fraternal Order of Police does not want it. You know, like Mr. Judson said, they question, you know, whether citizens can make that judgment. But the thing is, if you have what the caller said, retired judges on the panel, then you're going to have the same people objecting, saying, well, the judges are not representative citizens. The judges do not live in these areas where people are getting, you know, dealing with police violence. They don't live in high crime areas.
You know, it should be pointed out, retired judges have been brought back to process all of the foreclosure cases in the state of Florida, and they've come under a lot of criticism for the so-called rocket docket. No matter who you appoint, there's going to be some controversy coming from somewhere, is what I'm saying.
Big time.
And therein lies the rub. Our criminal justice system begins with civilians and it ends with civilians. The sheriff doesn't get to make that call. He can voice his opinion and say what he's opposed to, as can the police union. But the reality is that civilians have been asking for this for years. And if the system can't make it fair, then we see the results of it on the street. Now, I understand that there is a movement within council, once again, among the younger council members, to try to get this civilian review board up again on some docket. I don't know how successful they are going to be to get it in committee. But that's the whole point of the argument, is that we have sheriffs like ours, conservatively elected, who are not going to even consider this because they work on behalf of the police officers, not on behalf of the citizens who elect them. But if the majority of the citizens who elect you are conservative and white, you don't have to worry about what the other folks do because they don't elect you. And that's the point of this exercise. If we can't, many of these folks across the country are saying, if we can't get our elected officials to listen to us, if we can't get the persons in charge of the police force to listen to us to make this change, then some people are going to take this into their own hands. And that's the whole argument here. It's not a question of whether or not the sheriff likes it or doesn't want it. It's a question of what constituency has the power to make him listen.
Well, I'll tell you what constituency. The state legislature, they're the ones that can change charter. All council can do, as Councilman Reggie Brown told me after that public notice meeting about civilian reboards last month, is basically pass a resolution. The rub there is that everybody wants police union support. If you are passing that resolution, you're going to get hit in 4 years with a challenger backed by the police union, with everybody knocking on doors and doing all the things, leveraging in the way. And when you look at the state legislature also, they all want that police union endorsement, and if they don't get it, they're probably not getting elected.
And there
I
you
know.
Go.
We're going to get a few more of your calls and tweets on the air about this, as five police officers were shot and killed in Dallas overnight during a protest about police violence. And, of course, lots of people want to have their say. We are going to move on in a moment, though, and discuss some other news of the week. As John tweets the show, we don't know the shooter's intent, but this will only further the divide. Everyone will be on edge. Protests will be seen as dangerous. Let's go to Matthew on the north side. Go ahead, Matthew. Okay, Matthew, give us a call back. Kelly in Jacksonville. Hi, Kelly. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm going to turn my radio off.
Yeah, please do.
Hi. I'm Kelly McFarlane. I'm an African-American woman. I have four children, four sons, 31, 29, 26, and 14. I've raised my children to respect themselves and respect other people. My concern and the conversation that we're having right now needs to happen not just today, but every day of the week. Over the 4th of July holiday, 40-plus people in Chicago, Illinois, were murdered due to gun violence. And the majority of those people were African-American men. My concern is, why are no one speaking about this black-on-black crime? Why does it have to be that when a police officer, white or black, kills an African-American man, then the news just takes it and runs with it? Why are people not discussing this black-on-black crime? Where is the Al Sharpton? Where is the leadership in the African-American community? We have to be responsible for our own actions. I'm a little emotional right now because it's not right. Where is that conversation? And we want to put all of this blame. I agree with the black I understand Black Lives Matter. But I want to know, if Black Lives Matter so much, why are we not discussing in our community these black men, African-American men, murdering one another? Why does it have to be big news when a police officer killed a black man? I don't get that part.
Okay.
Where is the leadership? When are we going to take responsibility? That's the problem that I have.
Thanks, Kelly. That's Kelly in Jacksonville. Let me just say, Kelly, I tried to contribute to that conversation quite some time ago with a documentary I made about all of the issues in Jacksonville, not just black-on-black crime, but that's part of it, with our murder rate, a film called The 904. But you know what, Mark, Fred, what about her point of view?
She's valid. She's got a very valid point. And again, I've believe it or not, Melissa, I've looked at 904 a couple of times, and I'm hoping some kind of way we can find a way to get it done again. But it is a discussion, and some actions that have to be taken within the African American community here, the Hispanic community in far out west, in South Texas, the Puerto Rican community up in the Northeast. It is a discussion that has to take place, and it is something that does have to continually be worked on within those communities, because there's no excuse for what is taking place on the streets of Chicago. But you know what? It only takes place in one section of town. And that section of town always, in every community, is the same section of town in which there are food deserts, in which the police officers do not get out of their cars, in which community policing is something that you talk about that really isn't done, in which the jobs are just not there, and the income levels are at or below the poverty level. And despite the fact that we had scattered housing here in Jacksonville, guess where most of the Section 8 rental housing ended up? That's the issue that's at the root of many of these problems here, because where there is more affluence, there is less crime. Where there's more education, there is less crime and the less need for the police to be there. And as long as we continue to operate, I'm going to use a word here that could get me in trouble, but as long as we continue to move down a full capitalist line and not be willing to share all of the benefits of our American society, we're going to have this particular problem.
Mark.
Yeah, first of all, I think that it's really difficult to look at your own community and to point out the problems. So when we're looking at, you know, an African-American community that, as the caller points out, is having violence and struggles in itself, I think that it's very difficult to dissect that as opposed to looking at other communities. So
David.
As opposed to...
Yeah, AG.
Yeah, I mean, this thing, though, you know, what Fred said is worth mentioning, because you look at the areas where these issues happen and, you know, you've got, you know, issues with, you know, food deserts, you got lack of jobs, you've got basically a situation where people are too far away to get to their jobs, and you see the incentivization of illegal activities. In Jackson, we see a lot of gang shootings, a lot of people fighting over corners, and for what? For nothing. And, you know, it's like $30 here or a bag here or something like that. It's, you know, life is cheap, and we have not resolved these issues, and America is descending into third world outcomes. If an African-American baby in Jacksonville, you know, dies, you know, in its first year.
We have an infant mortality rate in this city on the north side that's like a third world
country.
It's
like the Gaza Strip, because I did a parallel when Lindsay Kilbride did the story for y'all. And, you know, we have a section of the city that is comparable to the Gaza Strip and that outcome and others. And that is the reality, and they feel like they're in the Gaza Strip dealing with the police officers.
David.
Well, I mean, I think there is a tension on, if not black-on-black crime, just in terms of murder in general in Jacksonville. And it's been a halting discussion over the years. You know, we had a mayor who was elected who made it a central issue in his campaign that, you know, nobody should grow up in a neighborhood or in a zip code where you see a best friend shot and killed while they're in their teenage years. There has been that discussion. To Fred's point, it draws from a lot of different areas, and it's not just crime. The moment somebody pulls a trigger, there's this large social dynamic that's feeding into that.
Absolutely. And I know a lot of people are waiting on hold, but we do need to move on and talk about a couple of other news and notes from the week. The number to join us, 549-2937. Now, also making headlines this week, multiple sources are reporting that Congresswoman Corrine Brown will be indicted on public corruption charges today. She's expected to be arraigned in a little while downtown in Jacksonville's federal court. The charges are related, we're told, to Brown's involvement with an unregistered charity in Virginia. Back in March, the House Ethics Committee in D.C. said it had opened up an investigation of Brown just weeks after the director of a charity with ties to her office pleaded guilty to fraud and agreed to cooperate with federal prosecutors. Local television spoke to Brown at the Jacksonville International Airport, and here's what she had to say.
Do you think this is politically motivated?
It's no question.
No question?
No question.
It's no question it's politically motivated?
Absolutely.
Who do you think?
Not only just political, racially motivated.
Okay. Congresswoman Corrine Brown saying that if the indictment comes down, that she sees this as a political and racially motivated witch hunt.
Yeah. She does. And, you know, she's framed it that way with the challenge to the district lines, too. And, you know, there are a lot of questions remaining about what the nature of that indictment is going to be. You know, what is certain is Corrine Brown is going to run for re-election regardless. And she's in a tight race with Al Lawson. Basically, the east side of the district, they like Corrine. They're supporting her by like 30 points. Once you get west of Jacksonville County line, you know, you've got, you know, the same dynamic in reverse for Lawson. And, you know, this is a really important issue for Jacksonville in ways that the media is not recounting, because they're looking at the scandal. They're looking at potential legal issues. And the fact is, if Al Lawson wins, we lose the seat, because Al Lawson is the guy who came to Jacksonville and he couldn't name Eureka Garden. He called it the place that Marco Rubio visited. So, you know, this is something that people need to consider. And as they pile on Corrine Brown and, you know, convict her before a trial, I mean, yeah, it looks bad for her. But, you know, the real issue is, you know, we're already losing Andrew Crenshaw, and we very well could lose Corrine Brown. And even if she wins and, you know, gets convicted, then there would be a special election. That's another dynamic.
Mark Judson, let's talk about what could be in this sealed indictment. We learned earlier this year that Brown had an aide who decided to cooperate with federal prosecutors about questionable activities around this charity called One Door for Education.
Yeah, I mean, with this charity, I mean, it wasn't even registered as a nonprofit in Virginia. It had $800,000, I believe it was, go to it. Only about $1,000 actually went to the education fund that it was supposed to be set up and intended for. It was being run out of a house. So I think that there's a lot of red flags that are popping off, as got mentioned earlier. And I think that those are all things that are looking very bad for Hoard in this case.
Fred Matthews, what about Congresswoman Brown's response to this? It's been a probe now that's been going on a good part of this year, that this is politically and racially motivated.
Well, conspiracy theory time. If she hadn't decided to run for office, maybe she would not be getting indicted. It's happened to public official after public official all across the country. We can remember the congressman in Louisiana who hid all the cash in his, in a box?
In a refrigerator.
Dollarville Jefferson.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Jefferson.
Shout out Nate Monroe.
You know, it's happened to them time and time again. If he hadn't decided to run for reelection, he probably would not have had gotten so publicly humiliated, but he's serving time now anyway, or just getting out. So, I mean, it is politically motivated. She's a public official. That's why she was being targeted, because she's a public official. That's why we've had in the council now, the House District 13 seat. I did a piece on that the other day. We've had Don Gaffney. We've had John Thomas. We've got Reggie Fullwood.
Tracy Davis.
Tracy Davis.
Some Republicans. Mark Griffin, too.
Yeah, but we've had three in that House seat alone who were prosecuted, and one more that may be going to prison behind it because you're a public official. So this is not new news. It's just that it could be tough news for Jacksonville to lose such an influential congressperson.
David.
Well, I don't really see her argument, what the basis of it is. I mean, it's Justice Department and a Democratic administration. It's headed by an African-American. I say it's racially and politically motivated. I don't know what her basis is for that. I mean, the case is basically, as I understand it, someone set up a charity, convinced people to donate to a charity, and then the allegation is use that money for personal gain. So, you know, the argument that should we expect more from public officials? Yes, absolutely. But the idea that someone could do this and not be prosecuted if that was brought to the attention of the federal authorities, I just don't buy that.
Well, we want to talk about a new poll looking at a couple of other public officials that also generated quite a bit of discussion this week. As the UNF polling lab finds incumbent state attorney Angela Corey and public defender Matt Shirk could be in trouble, both, according to the poll, behind by double digits in their respective races against challengers Melissa Nelson and Charles Cofer. The Corey campaign says its own polling shows Angela Corey up by double digits. But we're 5-6 weeks out from the August 13th primary. And these two incumbents who've been dogged by a number of scandals and issues over their tenures, they are facing strong challengers.
Yeah. Shirk and Corey both are being out-fundraised by opponents, Shirk by Cofer and, Corey by Melissa Nelson. And that poll that Corey's team pushed out in response to the UNF poll, that was a sorry exercise in manipulation of the media. It was a month old. It was a poll of 300 people. It was basically statistically meaningless. And another thing about the UNF poll itself is that it revealed that both Corey and Shirk are less popular with Republicans than independents and Democrats. So all those machinations about closing the primary, you know, recruiting sketchy candidates, it seems like Republicans, at least those polled by UNF and also by St. Pete's poll last week, are rejecting this. They don't see it as Republican values. They don't see it as conservatism. They see it as an incumbent clinging to their job. And Angela Corey's got to find a way to make an affirmative case. And what she's been doing lately is just basically attacking the media. And Matt Shirk, instead of making his own affirmative case, is just attacking Angela Corey. It's ironic.
Mark Judson, our UNF panelist this morning.
You know, I think that AG he touched on a great point about Corey not being viewed as, you know, a conservative figure, a strong conservative figure, and that's something with Nelson that they are really chiming in on. So even though Corey has a lot of political support from some of her former mayors, there's a lot of money going into Nelson right now, and a lot of strong individuals that are really looking at a strong conservative background that hasn't really seen as much controversy or challenges, Corey.
Well, it has certainly been a busy news week. Thanks for breaking it all down for us. Fred Matthews, Mark Judson, David Bauerlein, and A.G. Gankarski. Gentlemen, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Much more still to come on the show. Back in a moment.
Wolfson Children's Hospital uses toys and games to comfort kids in the hospital. Toy supplies run low in the summer, so we invite the community to help during our Christmas in July toy and donation drive, now through July 25th. Learn more at ChristmasJuly.com.
Jobs.Jacksonville.com is focused on helping employers in Northeast Florida find applicants for open positions. On the web, applicants can do a search, view listings, and apply for jobs. Jobs.Jacksonville.com is bringing local employers and candidates together. Vistar Credit Union, committed to offering its members home mortgage options that fit their life. Vistar, we never forget that it's your money. Information available at 777-6000 or vistarcu.org.
Mayo Clinic, caring for people with heart conditions including myocarditis, atrial fibrillation, and heart failure. Their integrated teams of specialists work together to achieve the precise care that patients need. Learn more at mayoclinic.org.
Nearly 50 years ago, Neil Armstrong left behind his iconic footprint on the moon, along with food bags and all sorts of equipment. Should the Apollo landing site be protected as an historical landmark? I'm Ira Flatto. Join me on Science Friday for a look at space archaeology, preserving human artifacts left on the moon and in orbit. All on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the family of legendary comedian Joan Rivers recently settled a high-profile medical malpractice lawsuit around her death. Rivers died after a routine laryngoscopy and endoscopy at an outpatient New York surgery center. Now, this month, July, is Medical Malpractice Awareness Month. And in fact, medical mistakes are actually the third leading cause of death in the U.S. after heart disease and cancer. A study from the Journal of Patient Safety estimates as many as 400,000 people who go to the hospital each year die from preventable mistakes, not their underlying disease. Joining us this morning with more medical malpractice attorneys, Matt Sal and Fadi Shakur, MD, from the Terrell Hogan Firm. Gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning.
Fadi, let's start with the Joan Rivers case. She went in for a routine outpatient procedure. And the world was shocked when she died. It was later determined that the case has been settled, but the allegations were that the surgical staff committed malpractice.
That's true. And based on the records that were made public, we were able to glean that, in fact, she went for a routine upper GI. She was having some voice changes. Doctor suspected acid reflux as a cause.
Mm-hmm. I've had that done myself.
You have?
Yeah, I had an endoscopy done at the Borland Groover Clinic because of acid reflux. Many Americans have had that done.
That's a routine procedure, yeah. And nobody should die from from that procedure. So in that procedure room, there were an anesthesiologist, the medical director who was going to perform the upper GI, and the ENT doctor. What happened is that the ENT doctor was allowed to take the lead, although she was not licensed to perform any procedures in that clinic, and decided to do the laryngoscopy first, which is an examination of the vocal cords.
Uh-huh.
The anesthesiologist noticed, initially objected, but then noticed after the laryngoscopy that the vocal cords were irritated and swollen. The procedure occurred, then the GI, upper GI also took place, and then the ENT physician decided to do another laryngoscopy. The anesthesiologist objected again, but allowed the procedure to go on. Long story short, the vocal cords were so irritated, they became swollen and obstructed the airway.
Mm-hmm.
They attempted to do a intubation to restore the airway. The swelling was so severe that was not accomplished. The only life-saving measure was a tracheostomy, but the ENT doctor, who was the only one who could do that, had already abandoned the patient and left the room. 12 minutes later, 911 was called. By that time, the brain damage from lack of oxygen was irreversible.
It was too much. It is really shocking, Matt Sal, to see that medical mistakes are the third leading cause of death in this country, as many as 400,000 deaths a year. Why are those numbers so high?
Well, it is shocking. There's a range that's been calculated based on the best evidence available between 210,000 and 440. At the high end of that range, you're talking about as many deaths as the United States military experienced during all of World War II. At 200, the low end of the range, you're talking about the equivalent of four Southwest airline jets crashing every single day all year long with no survivors. But it really is an unacceptable number. But the thing you need to keep in mind is that the vast majority of medical care in the United States is very, very good. But when you have a country with a population of 340 million people, just a small medical error percentage rate produces huge numbers. So when you spread that range of deaths across the country, unless the patient is a celebrity like Joan Rivers or some other event drawing large attention like this, mm-hmm. that magnitude of the problem can go unnoticed.
What are some of the main errors in hospitals and operating rooms that lead to these high numbers?
Some of the errors that we've seen over and over again are the lack of communication between the healthcare providers themselves and the healthcare providers and the patient. To give you an example, in a recent case we're handling, a patient went for a CT scan of the chest because of coughing up blood, and the CT showed a small mass on the right lung. The radiologist appreciated the mass, put it in his report, but never told the patient, never told the ordering physician. Almost a year later, the patient had another CT, which showed that the mass has grown substantially and spread all over his body, and he died shortly mm-hmm. after.
So if you're a patient and you're going into the hospital or going under for a procedure, what advice do you have for people to make sure that you come out on the other side, basically? What should people be aware of?
Well, first of all, ask as many questions as you can before the procedure, what the procedure. Do your own research. Online resources are huge now, and they provide you with a lot of information. Have an advocate. If you think you will not be able to ask questions, have someone, a family member, ask these questions for you before and after the procedure.
Matt Sal.
I think the most important thing is to take all medical care seriously. Remember, this is potentially life-threatening. And you need to give it dedicate the kind of time and effort to learning more about it yourself. We talked about second opinions from unaffiliated physicians. I just think it's important that people take it more seriously, and communication ultimately is critical.
Thanks so much for being with us, Matt Sal and Fadi Shakur, MD from the Terrell Hogan Law Firm. For more about medical malpractice, it's terrellhogan.com. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And we'll be right back.
Ansbacher Law assists condo and homeowners associations facing challenges with collecting delinquent assessments. Barry Ansbacher has a dedicated collections department that is sensitive to the needs of your community. More at 737-4600 or jackscondolawyer.com. Enterprise Florida, working to build a strong economy for Florida's children and grandchildren while striving to make the state an engine for job growth for generations to come. Florida, the future is here.com.
The Quality Education for All Fund believes our teachers in the Rebalt, Rains, and Jackson feeder pattern are raising student achievement, QEA, dedicated to making a difference in our public schools and creating believers. Learn more at QEAfund.org.
Goodwill of North Florida. Donate, shop, jobs. Good things for North Florida with Goodwill. Proud supporters of WJCT's First Coast Connect. GoodwillJax.org for more info.
They say context is everything. At All Things Considered, we take the time to put things in their proper place, delving into the why and the how of a story, not just the who, what, and where. We pinpoint what's truly important and grasp the ideas that bring the news into focus. I'm Audie Cornish. Join us every afternoon for All Things Considered from NPR News, because the facts matter.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Well, finally this hour, we're going to tell you about the Swim Shorts Film Festival, a brand new event celebrating our area's waterways all through the lens of your camera. Now, the festival invites filmmakers of all ages and abilities to send them short films featuring Northeast Florida waters and or your favorite water activities, surfing, swimming, boating, whatever it is. All proceeds from this festival will go to the St. John's Riverkeeper. Festival creator Laura Burl is here to tell us about the Swim Shorts Film Festival. And this sounds really cool. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
You created this. How'd the idea come to you?
I have always loved Florida's unique waterways, and I was filming a St. John's Riverkeeper presentation at FSEJ, and I was just very inspired, and I thought, you know, I need to get these people some money.
Yeah, this is a creative way to do it.
Yes, yes.
So you want anyone who has any filmmaking ability to participate. What kind of submissions are you looking for?
It really can be anything. The whole idea is just to get people interested and out there. And, I mean, it could literally be about a glass of water in your house. You don't have to have any special equipment. You don't have to have any special abilities. I just want everyone to participate.
And this is a way to fund the Riverkeeper, but also to sort of celebrate what makes this region unique, as you said, the beauty of our river and our beaches.
Yes, and our very unique aquifer. Our springs are fantastic and unique in the world.
You've already started getting submissions. There's already a lot of interest, so you might extend the deadline, right?
Yes, yes. I am definitely wanting to extend the deadline. I'm getting a lot of emails. People are very – they just want some more time. They want to perfect their craft.
Well, what are some of the submissions you've been getting so far? What's it looking like out there?
Oh, my goodness. It's so much fun. We've gotten some science fiction.
Really?
Yes, some post-apocalyptic, living by water, vagabond stuff. We've got some free diving videos from some of the springs, which is really great because I get to see some springs in a perspective I've never been able to see before.
And what are the criteria for people that are just now hearing about this? How can they submit, and what are the rules? What are the criteria for their short film?
It has to be 5 minutes long or less.
Okay.
It can be about a Northeast Florida waterway or, you know, like you said earlier, anything involving water, anything. I just ask that people not do anything dangerous beyond their abilities.
Right.
Don't harm any environments around them.
Uh-huh.
And don't throw your camera in the water unless it's got a really good seal.
Exactly. Now, there's going to be an actual screening, a festival, later this summer.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Sunray Cinema has very graciously offered us their large theater to screen all of the finalists. And that night, August 18th, will be the same night when we present prizes to the top winners.
All right, and that's a little ways out, but if you have an idea, the deadline is looming, but Laura says it may be extended.
Yes.
If you go to the website, swimshortsfilmfest.org, swimshortsfilmfest.org, the inaugural Swim Shorts Film Festival wants your short film, 5 minutes or less, celebrating our Northeast Florida waterways. Full disclosure, I'm one of the judges. Thank you for asking me.
Thank you for being one.
I can't wait to see all of the creative projects that are coming in.
Me too.
Laura Burl, creator of the Swim Shorts Film Festival. Talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Well, that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show. Video on demand segments with our partners, TVJax.com, MetroJacksonville.com. We'll dive in Reams up next with a look at the week's top national news stories. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. Stay cool out there this weekend. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.